Welcome to the Binder Family Speaker Series, a podcast dedicated to high-level research on contemporary anti-Semitism by fostering productive and collegial discussion of the most pertinent issues before us. Hosted by the Indiana University Institute for the Study of Contemporary Anti-Semitism. For more information about this speaker series, ISCA news, or videos of past webinars, please visit our website at isca.indiana.edu. And now to present our speaker, Dr. Alvin H. Rosenfeld.
And welcome everyone who's tuned in. It's really a pleasure, Dan, to see you, although it would be even more so in Israel itself. God willing, that'll be the case in the period ahead. For those of you who are looking in today, I'll say a few words only about Professor Michman. He taught for many years at Bar-Ilan University. His fields have been modern Jewish history and the history and historiography of the Shoah. Also, he has served a hugely important role as a historian in residence, chief historian in residence at Yad Vashem, where he oversaw the international programs on the study of the Holocaust. He's a widely published author. He himself works in several languages. His books have been translated into no less than a dozen of those languages. So we really are privileged to have someone of Dan Michman's caliber with us today. The subject that he's going to be addressing is a very, very topical one. As we all know, we're in the midst of an escalation of hostility against Jews. Those of us who study the problem know that anti-Semitism waxes and wanes over time and in different places. It's our misfortune to be living at a time when, in fact, it's returned with a good deal of energy. But there are lots of debates about what anti-Semitism precisely is, how it's defined, how helpful the term is. And as a historian of these matters, Professor Michman has already had important things to say about the origins of the term, the progress of the term, and some of the debates about the use of the term. Dan, it's now my pleasure to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, both Günther and Alvin, for the introduction. And I'm glad and honored to be the first speaker in the new series these talks organized by the Institute for the Study of Contemporary Antisemitism at Indiana University. And I'll try to share a PowerPoint presentation which will accompany. Where is it? Now, what's going on now? Oh, can you see it?
Very good, yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so I'll start. And in the immediate post-World War II period, Jews and many non-Jews believed that the horrors of the Shoah had discredited anti-Semitism to such an extent that beyond some unpleasant remnants, the phenomenon would disappear. And indeed, for several decades, this assessment seemed to be confirmed, at least in the Western liberal world. One of the symptoms of this was the fact that, for instance, courses on anti-Semitism at universities were not taught anymore since the 1980s. And I can testify to my own conduct in this field. I taught courses at the end of the 1970s, the beginning of the 1980s, and afterwards went to other directions. And unfortunately, the term anti-Semitism has become popular again and hasn't remained a fossil from the far past. Therefore, in recent years, centers and institutes for the study of anti-Semitism were established in various countries, and many conferences dealing with the topic, whether academic ones or ones that are more practical, focusing on means to combat anti-Semitism in its various forms, are convened. The current series and also the institute, I think, testifies to this phenomenon. Now, in a provocative article published in 2009 entitled "Away from the Definition of Anti-Semitism," New York University historian David Engel demanded, and I quote, "eschewing anti-Semitism as a ready-made category," end of quote, "and as a legitimate and analytical concept for scholars to be used, because, first of all, the term is vague and scholars disagree regarding its definition." That's what he said. "And secondly, because since the 19th century, it has been a political tool. That is, it is manipulated and manipulative by itself." And Engel wrote, let's see here. Engel wrote, now I quote, "Throughout the centuries, many people have behaved violently towards Jews. Many have depicted them verbally or artistically in a derogatory fashion, agitated publicly for the subjection to legal discrimination, discriminated against them socially, or privately felt varying degrees of prejudice towards or emotional revulsion from them. However," and I now emphasize this sentence, "no necessary relation among particular instances of violence, hostile depiction, agitation, discrimination, and private unfriendly feeling across time and space can be assumed. Indeed, none has ever been demonstrated." And end of quote. So this statement wraps up a 24 pages essay, which has as its subtitle, and I quote again, "An Essay in the Semantics of Historical Description." His study, Engel's study of the use of the term anti-Semitism since the end of the 1870s, is detailed and quite sophisticated. Yet, due to his goal to prove the vagueness of the concept and the disagreement regarding its semantic boundaries, he started by saying that, and I quote again, "the term anti-Semit came into common usage in Germany during the early 1880s as a designation for particular individuals and groups demanding an end to recently adopted legal arrangements that had, to their minds, granted Jews undue influence over cultural, social, economic, and political life in their country. Contrary to what is widely believed today," and now I emphasize the following, "those individuals and groups do not appear to have been united by any common set of ideas beyond a general feeling that the legal arrangements they opposed were liable to cause German society long-term harm," end of quote. Engel even added in a footnote that, and I quote again, "it is not clear why the name caught on or what was most responsible for its popularity." Now, I do not disagree that the broadening and advancing integration of Jews in the general societies in the 19th century, what we call emancipation of the Jews, resulting to a large extent from the long-term effects of the emancipation process that had started at the end of the 18th century, played an important role in the political activities of the anti-Semitic movements in the last decades of the 19th century, though there were some other developments too that had an impact. However, even though Engel claimed to focus on semantics, his semantic analysis is deeply flawed, because by starting his description and analysis while looking at a phenomenon since the beginning of the 1880s in Germany, he skipped the formative period of the history of the term, which preceded the 1880s. Moreover, he has been blind to a fundamental aspect of the methodology of the history of concepts. What is the reason behind the coining of a concept at a certain time? And what can be learned from its form and construction regarding its semantics? And this is what I want to do now here in this talk regarding the term anti-Semitism. From a linguistic point of view, it should be emphasized that new terms are coined by speakers when they feel that in the existing vocabulary, there is no word whose semantic field covers the specific meaning of what they want to express. The coining itself can be done by official bodies or spontaneously by individuals, a phenomenon that is most common in slang and colloquial discourse. Many invented terms remain personal and rapidly fade away. But when there is a feeling by a broader audience that the term fills in a gap, it catches on and is widely accepted after a short term time, even entering the dictionaries. And you remember that Engels said that he doesn't know why it caught on. Also, sometimes a new term is invented to upgrade a position or concept which has a negative or derogative connotation, although the semantics remain more or less the same. Such a case in 19th century discourse, for instance, is the replacing of the term Jew by the apparently more honorable term Israelite in French, or Israelite in German and Dutch, right? I should perhaps here explain that this term was coined and introduced into discourse in the beginning of the 19th century. Actually, we know exactly when. We don't know the person who really promoted it, but in 1808, around the establishment of consistories in France and Westphalia and the Netherlands, on the initiative of Napoleon Bonaparte, who wanted to turn all the religions into denominations under the supervision of the state, they introduced there the term, and we can see it happening within several months in the beginning of 1808. And Israelite is therefore a designation for the religion of the Jews, but it is also a nice word because Jew had a derogative connotation for many. So this was an upgrading of the concept of Jews, and also changing a little bit its status in the modern state. So this is one example which is important in our context, especially when we think about it, that the term Israelite became common in legislation at the end of the 19th century, in the beginning of the 20th century. In Germany and in Austria, for instance, the Jewish community is called Israelitische Kultusgemeinde. And when the Nazis came to power in 1933, they switched the development back, and they started to use the term Jew anew instead of Israeli. So consequently, when dealing with the term antisemitismus or anti-Semitism, the context of and the reason behind its emergence should be explored. If its meaning was anti-Jewish action resulting from hatred or opposition to Judaism, then of course there were existing terms that were in use before. The veteran Judenhass, Jew hatred, and the newer anti-Judaismus, anti-Judaism, which was used in theological studies and Bible research, especially Bible criticism in its early stages. Following the above explained conditions for the emergence of new terms and concepts, it becomes clear that the term antisemitismus appeared in public discourse as a result from the feeling of certain people in the mid-19th century that Judenhass and anti-Judaismus did not express their understanding of their opposition and animosity towards the real or imagined Jews, and to what turns the various Jews into a tightly bounded collective. Wilhelm Marr, who established the Antisemitenliga at the end of the 1870s, declared already in 1862 in his publication Der Judenspiegel, The Mirror of the Jews, and it said it is a fact that every social union or association in which the Jews get a kind of preponderance over the Christians cannot persevere. The reason is not religious hatred, from one side. Such a hatred does not exist among educated people. It is, however, the alien character or essence of his very being, which is, if we may say so, chemically unbearable, and which leads to the resolution of the body through, if we may say so, an anorganic process. We can turn the issue around or toss it as much as we would like, yet we will always arrive at a point where we will have to admit that it is not a certain Jew, but the Jews as a collective, Judentum in German, which is revolting from our perspective. End of quote. So according to Marr, the resistance to all Jews is not a result of hatred or religious rivalry. It is something essential, deriving from nature, and consequently unchangeable. This understanding of the animosity towards the Jews, which claimed to be scientific, was the drive behind the emergence and crystallization of the concept antisemitismus. In the term antisemitismus itself, one has to discern three particles: anti or anti, zemit, and ismus, ism. Each of these particles is meaningful and should be explained, especially when compared with Judenhass. Anti replaced hatred, Hass. Zemit replaced Jews, Juden, and the suffix ism, ismus, was added to the term as something new. Anti is a neutral, non-emotional linguistic particle meaning being against, using science to indicate forces or processes that resist or neutralize other forces or processes. Zemit is a term from the domain of linguistics, which became popular in the 1850s and 1860s. In the wake of archaeological findings in the preceding century in India and Iraq, ancient Mesopotamia, linguists concluded that there were what they called original languages, Ursprache, from which later sub-languages developed, and that thus we have in current times language families. Indo-European language, which developed from Sanskrit in India, Semitic languages, which developed from an ancient proto-Semitic language. The French linguist and historian Joseph Ernst Renan introduced and popularized the term Semitic languages in his book Histoire générale et système comparé des langues sémitiques, General History and Comparing System of Semitic Languages in 1855. And 4 years later, in his follow-up book, Nouvelle Considération sur le caractère général des peuples sémitiques, et en particulier sur leur tendance au monothéisme. So this is interesting. We said novel considerations about the general character of Semitic peoples, and especially about their tendency towards monotheism. So he made a direct link between the characteristics of Semitic languages to the speakers of these languages. That is, the characteristics of these languages represent characteristics of all the individuals who speak them. As he firmly believed that languages express the inner character of their speakers, he consequently believed that the Semitic peoples had a certain common character, a main feature of being monotheistic. By doing so, Renan added an important element to the race theories that had developed since the second quarter of the 18th century, that is, more than a century before, who believed that there is an inherent link between the shape and form of people, and especially their external appearance and their eternal characteristics, that is, their physical and mental capabilities. It begins with Linnaeus, a Swedish scholar, in a book published in 1738, Systema Natura, the System of Nature, where he discerns four races: white, black, yellow, and red. And this is taken up later by other scholars, Lamarck at the end of the 18th century. And this from this develops a certain racial essentialism, and it becomes a common concept and is then strengthened in the mid-19th century. And it's very important to emphasize here that a development of the mid-19th century is that science becomes very important, that it replaces philosophy. People see the achievements of the sciences, and they believe that this can explain also social behavior and other developments. Now, in an article, and being Semitic thus, or Aryan, by the way, is a term from Sanskrit, which it was embraced in racial theories, meant from now on having a certain unchangeable nature-based form and character. Now, in an article published in 1873 in the Monatsschrift für Geschichte und Wissenschaft des Judentums, the Jewish monthly for Jewish history and science, established by Rabbi Zacharias Franco, the journal editor Wilhelm Bacher wrote that, and I'll quote from an article that he wrote, a new characterization of the Semites, since Rahman made public his well-known theory about Aryans and Semites in his Histoire générale et systèmes comparés des langues sémitiques, the image of the latter became entrenched in science and literature, and it has become an axiom to speak about the Semites, with only some exceptions, with the same haughtiness, the same Aryan arrogance as did the French scholar. Indeed, certain counter-arguments were raised against some points, yet the best refutation, a description of the differences between those two most important people collectives from the historical and linguistic perspectives, which are anchored in a firmer basis and are consequently less arbitrary, has not been done. This has to be regretted even more because due to this distorted image, the latent Jew hatred, Judenhass, which especially in Germany still exists among many writers and journalists, could become a widespread phenomenon, so to say, appearing as Semite hatred, Semitenhass, and not so rarely pour out its rage under the auspices of a pseudo-scientific shield on the Semitic misters who had become too powerful. End of quote. This text is important for our analysis because Bacher testified to the conversion of the term Jew hatred into Semite hatred and to its broadly spreading in common discourse. This conversion occurred quite rapidly within several years between the mid-1850s, when Renan's first book came out, and the beginning of the 1870s. The origins of the conversion are to be found in the rapid penetration of terms from the academic scientific arena into the general discourse, whether scholarly or journalistic. However, in the process of conversion of the linguistic concept into a social one, the semantics of Semites as a designation for various Middle Eastern peoples also changed and became to designate in European discourse in general, including the German discourse, Jews only. The reason was that the Jews were the real Semites that were present in most of the European continent at the time, and they had already been a problem before. So the term Semite thus gave a seemingly scientific label to the deeply entrenched anti-Jewish sentiments and acts, an act which linguistically upgraded Jew hatred and provided it with an apparently new justification. Semitenhass instead of Judenhass was one step in the conversion process. Adding the prefix anti and dropping the suffix hatred, has converted the term from an emotion-loaded one to an apparently neutral one, expressing natural non-emotional resistance to Jews, that is a reaction, whether biological, chemical, or physical. Just remember what Mars said in 1862, to them. In this context, it is important to emphasize that the Austrian Jewish bibliographer Moritz Steinschneider was apparently the first person to use or coin the term antisemitisch, not Wilhelm Marr, as a response to Renan's theory in a publication in the year 1860. So not, as I said, Wilhelm Marr in 1979, as it is still widely believed. Thus, Steinschneider launched a term into the broadening public discussion on language families and races and their social repercussions. In 1860, the term was coined as a response from the Jewish side to Renan's theory, expressing disagreement with it, but already understanding it as anti-Jewish. The semantics of the term developed within two decades, and the anti-Jewish activists, led by those who also held racial theories, embraced the term with appreciation. The third particle, ismus or ism, also needs a short explanation. Renan spoke about the character of the Semite, that is, their mode of thinking and behaving, not just as individuals, but as a collective. Consequently, a noun was coined, Semitismus, which meant the assumed Semitic way of thinking and behaving. When ism is added to a term, it means an ideology or world war, liberalism, socialism, a school of thought, behaviorism, an approach, anti-Judaism, and the like, based on an essential principle. Moreover, around the third quarter of the 18th century, another important development occurred as a result of the democratization process, which included the broadening of suffrage, the emergence of modern political movements and parties that crystallized their ideologies around certain fundamental principles: socialism, communism, anarchism, and shortly afterwards in the Jewish world, Zionism, territorialism, autonomism. All these movements and parties were characterized by the isms, which indicated the core principle of their worldviews. The emergence of the term antisemitismus has thus to be understood in this context. The anti-Semitic movement introduced into the contemporary political arena a political ideology that suggested that the Jewish threat was the reason behind the political, economic, social, and cultural upheaval, turbulence, and crisis of the time, which were indeed significant. Organized political anti-Jewish action would solve all these problems. In this new context, but building on and using long-standing anti-Jewish beliefs and images in which Jews and Judaism were identified with money, the term mammon, for instance, is very important in this context, Semitism became a term indicating an ideology of materialism and life based on the golden calf. In our terms today, we would say unbound or greedy capitalism. The goal was to build up an anti to this threat by pushing back what they called the Jewish influence. This did not mean only the cancellation of the emancipation of the Jews as individuals, but also a battle against Mammon, the Jewish-driven idol of modernity. In this way, the social and economic problems would all be solved. The evolving, destructive capitalist economy, the rapidly growing press world that penetrated every corner and criticized almost everything, the decomposition of values, the secularization, the negative developments that resulted from the urbanization, etc., etc. In the eyes of those who now openly and even proudly identify themselves as anti-Semites, the physical Jews were not only new competitors who penetrated from the margins into the social centers due to the emancipation that they had received, and which paved the way for them to enter almost all professions and walks of life without religious or class barriers. The Jews were the embodiment of all the big evils that occurred in that period. The economic, technological, and political transformations that undermined the old social and economic order. From this perspective, the Jews, or the Jew, their Jude, beyond their physical presence, were viewed as a symbol, the personification of a principle or phenomenon. The new term anti-Semitism expressed a stance vis-a-vis a phenomenon that was presented as Judaism, capitalist exploitation, communism, stupefying materialism, cosmopolitanism, evil permissiveness and the undermining of family values, violent free press and the like. The real Jews were the physical representatives of an abstract phenomenon. Thus, anti-Semitism was not a term that came into being to indicate the collective actions of various anti-Jewish activists, as Engel assumed, but the linguistic expression of a worldview. Indeed, within a very short period, at the end of the 1870s and the beginning of the 1880s, various anti-Jewish groups, and not only the racists, embraced the new term, and some aspects of the original meaning faded to a certain extent. But we should evaluate what happened in the light of these three developments. First, an up-to-date term originating in the linguistic and racial discourse was widely accepted in the general discourse within a very short period, also by non-racists. Secondly, the anti-Jewish sentiments were channeled to the political arena and used as a mobilizing factor and were now presented as one of the ideologies in a market of ideas. And thirdly, the pseudo-scientific term strengthened the public appearance of Jew hatred. So, we have to add an important feature, a contribution of the racial template, because in the modern era, especially in the 19th century, with the emancipation and the opening of the doors, we can find a development in modern Jewry into various religious, social directions, and also people leaving the Jewish community, not adhering anymore to the community as such. And therefore, it was hard to find a collective term for all of them. And the racial new term now provided the anti-Semites or the anti-Jewish activists with a semantic tool where you could relate to Jews, even those who were not discernible in the public arena. So in view, and we can see here something that goes back to the French Revolution, where the representative Stanislas de Clermont-Tonnerre said in 1789, we must refuse everything to the Jews as a nation and accord everything to Jews as individuals. And consequently, Judaism is categorized in the new states as a religion, and not all Jews, active Jews, and especially not secularized Jews, remained faithful to the religion. So that became a problem. So now the new term is a vehicle for defining the non-Jewish Jews and the Jewish Jews and the various groups of Jews as one collective again. In view of these features, it's clear that the new term was coined to express a new, apparently rational understanding of Jew hatred according to the interpretation of contemporaries. But it wasn't in its essence very different from earlier forms of Jew hatred. Consequently, it could be used by various anti-Jewish groups and ideologies, and it can be used also by scholars and us also for earlier periods, even though historically it was a new term. Moreover, counter to Engel's claim, it isn't difficult to see the connections between different anti-Jewish actions or expressions in different periods and different places, because there are recurring patterns of anti-Jewishness to which I will relate in a moment. Which leads me now to a final remark on the emergence of the term. Anti-Semitism, according to my understanding, is a family name for various shades and actions of a basic stance towards the Jews as a collective and towards Judaism as the conspirational thread that binds all Jews together and which is the motivation behind all Jewish behavior. As a historical phenomenon, it is difficult to provide a precise definition of the phenomenon. And in recent years, several definitions have emerged. I'll relate to them in a moment. But one could claim that the vagueness of its contours is part of the essence of this phenomenon. Nevertheless, there are several recurring characteristics which allow for the designation of a stance or event as anti-Semitic. And these characteristics are, first, the claim that the Jews are a negative or evil collective, which is different from all other human groups. And this is important to emphasize when you can see that, say, Jews are different from others. So there are also other evil groups and so on, but the Jews are a category apart. Secondly, even if there are seemingly many types of Jews, in reality, there is solidarity between them all, and a certain sinister thread combines all Jews. And that is what I mentioned regarding the new term of anti-Semitism, that it was a tool, a vehicle to see the all Jews as one collective. Thirdly, a basic difference of the Jews from all other negative human groups and enemies is them being the obstacle, the main obstacle for harmony, whether human, social, political, economic, and not just another problem. Nowadays, for instance, if Israel will not exist, then the Middle East will be quiet, right, for instance. And fourthly, the Jews are entirely rootless. They are not really attached to any location, even not to their country of origin, Palestine. And therefore they can and do move constantly from place to place throughout their history. And thus they can be found everywhere. This makes them the ultimate cosmopolitans. Then the Jews represent a destructive principle, anti-Christianity, Bolshevism, capitalism, greed. This principle is Judaism. Therefore, even if they are small in numbers at a certain place, the damage that they can and do cause is real and has an impact beyond their nominal number or the percentage of the total population. Moreover, the damage can be caused even in places where there are no Jews at all. The negativity of the Jews is expressed in the unnatural contradiction that characterizes them. They are physically weak, yet they are powerful and constantly aim at getting control over the Gentiles, the Goyim. Their physical appearance is ugly, yet they are sexually seducing. And they lack any moral. They apparently play the game of adhering to the rules of the surrounding societies, yet they are ready to break and transgress all rules or laws of the Goyim when they find it useful and profitable. And the Jews are driven by lust for power, lucre, and sex. So now we have showed, I think, the context of the emergence of the term anti-Semitism, but also that in spite of the historical context of this emergence, the term can be used for earlier periods too. My approach is that anti-Semitism should be understood as a long-standing tradition, a tradition that is based on a series of recurring elements, arguments, views, and images. Their ideological mantle may change from time to time and from place to place, but the elements, if one is aware of them, can be deciphered. There may be various attempts at defining the phenomenon. They are usually sociological and always have certain holes or uncovered aspects, but the proper way is to observe and monitor it, and in this way use the term and concept also for analysis. That is, a historically informed anthropological and cultural approach. The fact that there is also manipulation of the term and concept anti-Semitism should not prevent us from using it in proper academic analysis, always with proof and within the right context. On the other hand, avoiding or abstaining from using the term as the angle suggested can lead to the misunderstanding of real threats. Now, during about four decades after 1945, after the end of the Shoah and World War II, it seemed as if open anti-Semitism was a taboo. There is a decline in using the term and also expressions. And as I said in the beginning, also in teaching courses at universities. But the past decades have reversed the situation. Anti-Semitism has again been on the rise, and this institute, Alvin Rosenfeld, and others have dealt with it in many studies. There are now, however, also partners who are ready to fight the anti-Semitism in the legal arena and in education, being aware of its dangers for society in general. But here we have a problem. Anti-Israelism and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has added a new twist to anti-Semitism, and the possibility of hiding anti-Semitism behind the template of anti-Israelism. I just mentioned the musician Roger Waters, for instance, who is a good example. In the recent developments, the year 2001 with the Durban Conference has been very important, because that was a peak of anti-Israelism, which actually was anti-Semitic. And it has led also to push and to organize the battle against anti-Semitism. And this was what led to a first definition, a modern definition of anti-Semitism in 2005. It was later embraced by IRA. In 2016, this says anti-Semitism is certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as hatred toward Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, toward Jewish community institutions and religious facilities. Now, this is a non-binding definition, and there are examples afterwards, but it was composed in order to give a tool to police and governments to cope with anti-Semitism, the practical expressions of anti-Semitism. But there are many more expressions which can be found all around and which are not covered by this this definition. And we, features that I showed before, we can find them, and we can sometimes in a twisted language in the in literature or in a piece in the newspapers, where it is not openly anti-Semitic, but you can see formulation of the sentence and the images that are used, and you can really say that it is anti-Semitic. Now, the problem is that, as I said before, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has led to animosities also in the political field, has caused several scholars to promote a competing definition of anti-Semitism, and that is the Jerusalem definition of anti-Semitism 2021. I won't go into the particulars. They give some definition of historic anti-Semitism, but then come to the point where they say that there are aspects of criticisms of Israel, which I would call anti-Semitic, that they exclude from being anti-Semitic, because that is trying to appease, I would say, more leftist approaches to the conflict. And another definition appears in the Nexus document by the government of the United States. Was embraced by Biden, by President Biden recently, but there was a Nexus task force. Nexus is understanding the nexus between Israel and Zionism and anti-Semitism. And they give also their definition. I won't go into the particulars, but the important point here is that we can see that the debate about Israel and the anti-Zionist approaches, which are promoted often as a disguise for anti-Semitism, are now in the center, and this causes many to marginalize or not understand enough the widespread phenomenon of anti-Semitism beyond the aspect of the Middle Eastern conflict. So I'll end here with what is anti-Semitic. So I said, why suddenly these definitions, the Jerusalem Declaration and next documents are quite similar. They provide a general description of anti-Semitism with some examples, but the focus is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And they try to counter the IRA non-binding definition because they think that Israel is too much protected through this definition, which I disagree with. And the JDAA definition was signed by an impressive list of scholars who indeed deal with anti-Semitism, mostly through the perspective of the Shoah. However, it isn't clear if all really closely read the declaration and were aware of the motivations of its initiators. And I did some research on that and an analysis of signer networks reveals the present day political motivation behind this alternative definition. So I would say that we can wrap up with saying that we can continue with using the term. It is legitimate. However, one has to use the elements as specified above and how they are applied to Jewish individuals and the Jews as a collective. Nowadays, anti-Semitism can often also be found in the attitude toward Israel as an expression of the Jewish collective. Analyzing the claims against and behavior policies towards Israel will help, with the help of the specified elements, will reveal if they are anti-Semitic or bona fide, even if critical. None of the new definitions is perfect, and scholars should delve deeper into present-day texts, behaviors, and policies that they encounter, and into the exact anti-Semitic elements that are used, beyond stating that something is anti-Semitic. And in order to keep use of the term useful and helpful, proper use is needed, as always, in scholarship. So thank you for your attention. And that is, in a nutshell, what I had to say about this.